Moncrief on News Talk.
Time for Moncrief's Murder Club today. Cassie Delaney will be guiding us through some kind of unsolved criminal cases, but they can't. Most of them have a movie connection or sound like a movie.
Some of them do. They're all inspirational. Is at the core of it. So our first one is the Black Dahlia, and this is your as we were saying there off mic, your classic kind of. The press made it a little bit sexy. It was a bit sordid. This is back in 1947 in Los Angeles in California. And a woman is walking through the park. She notices something that looks like a department store mannequin and realizes quickly that it's not. It is a body that's been meticulously prepared. It's been drained of blood, cut cleanly in half at the waist, posed deliberately, symmetrically, just feet from the pavement. So whoever did this wanted the body to be discovered. Yeah. It was a very theatrical kind of murder. And an autopsy later revealed that this poor woman had been bound and tortured before she died. The cutting was deemed to be surgical in its precision. So whoever did it must have had some medical knowledge. That's kind of what the police concluded anyway from first observations. The woman was identified as Elizabeth Short. She was 22 years old. She'd come to LA from Boston. Dreams of becoming an actress, you know, most people in the 40s. She had no acting credits. She moved around frequently and worked as a waitress. And the press kind of gave her this really sort of sordid backstory that she courted many men and they nicknamed her the Black Dahlia. So she had dyed black hair and black clothing. And there had been a film noir in the cinemas the year before called The Blue Dahlia. So within days, the LAPD had 750 investigators on this case. The killer actually did that really theatrical and dramatic thing where he was making contact through the press. So an envelope arrived at the LA Examiner, wiped clean with gasoline, containing her address book, her birth certificate, and a note cut out from newspaper headlines. That classic little collage.
That is, yeah. You think they make that stuff up, but this is actually happening
in real life. Well, it has to come from somewhere, yeah. So he, in the kind of letters, he was saying that he would give up the Dahlia killing if I only get 10 years. Don't try to find me. And the case was so big. It was actually front page news for 35 consecutive days. So you'd imagine they'd get a lot of interest and they would at least spook the person who was responsible. Over 60 people confessed the murder, which is a really bizarre thing that often happens in a high case or, you know, kind of high profile crime like this. In the 78 years since, there's been over 500 confessions received in total.
You see, that's, and I think one of the fascinating aspects of that is we think Americans only went crazy recently, but no, it was always that
way. Been crazy, especially over that side. Always, always crazy. The investigation produced more than 150 suspects, but yielded absolutely no arrests. One name has popped up over and over again, though, and that is Dr. George Hodel. And he was a physician, brilliantly wealthy. He had moved around the kind of highest socialite circles of LA, kind of, you know, dapper man. At least 8 witnesses claimed that he had had a relationship with Short in the year before her death. And in 1950, his teenage daughter accused him of abuse. An 18-man police force were secretly bugging his home for 6 weeks, trying to catch him out on that accusation. And what they recorded is incredible. He was actually caught during that saying, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they can't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead.
Whoa.
So a kind of callous, cold man at the very least. And just the year before he used to be arrested, he fled the country and remained in Asia for the next 40 years. Only dying in 99 at the age of 91, never been charged with anything. But interesting, his son Steve is a retired LAPD homicide detective and he has spent years building a case against him, published a best-selling book and convinced the LA DA's head deputy that the case was solved, but they officially disagreed. So no one has ever been charged with the murder of Elizabeth Short and the case is technically officially open, the oldest active murder investigation in LA.
Yeah, and they did actually make a movie of it then,
they
subsequently
did.
In 2006, odd. It's such a strange...
Such a sinister
macabre
one.
Macabre case, yeah. Now, the next case of this chap, again, it's... You could see this in a movie because... Mm. And in fact, I think there was a movie recently out where a lot of it is conducted through people talking to each other, but they can't see each other and they don't know where they are.
Yeah, this is a really bizarre case. And a lot of the online theories about this are that Brandon somehow like jumped into like an alternative timeline, because where he thought he was and where his parents thought he was later proven different. But the weird thing about this case is he knew the area that he was driving in. He was very familiar with it. It was close to his home. So this is a case of Brandon Swanson. And he was on the 13th of May 2008, he was driving around rural Minnesota. He was 19 years old, first year college student, studying wind turbine technology. It was the last day of the semester and he went to a party with friends. He was said to have had a few drinks, but by no witness accounts was he deemed to be drunk. Mm. He did get into the car and start driving home, and he was driving the southwest of Minnesota. Again, he knew the area. So like he knew where he was going. He was very familiar. This is a friend's house. The journey between a friend's house and your parents' house, you've probably driven it dozens and dozens of times. But somewhere in the dark, he kind of hits upon this loose gravel and he makes a wrong turn and the car goes into a ditch. He isn't hurt and he gets out and he calls his parents to come collect him and give him some advice. So his parents, Brian and Annette Swanson, get in their truck immediately and they drive towards the town of Lind where he said he was. They stay on the phone with him the whole time. So they're talking through him. He's flashing his headlights so they can spot him. His parents are flashing their headlights so that they can see each other. And they can hear him on the other end of the line working the light switch on his end, clicking. And no matter how far they drive, they cannot find each other in the darkness. So for 45 minutes, they drive in circles going back and forth. Like they're not a big distance from the family home. They're talking to the son the whole time, unable to locate him. And at one point, Annette, as mothers would do, hangs up the phone in frustration.
Yes.
she's getting a bit thick with him. This is kind of annoying. But like there's no sense of emergency or urgency at this stage because they're just trying to find their son who's kind of, you know, maybe got a flat tire and fallen into the ditch. Brandon decides to leave the car and walk towards what he thinks are the flashing lights in the distance. Still on the phone, still talking. And then without warning, he kind of grumbles and shouts out curse words and the line goes completely dead. His parents call back immediately and he never answers. So when police use cell tower records to trace his last location later, they find that he was actually, in fact, 25 minutes away from where he thought he was, which is a very strange detail.
Yeah.
Near a town called Taunton, not Lind at all. There, his car is found. His keys are missing, so he took them with him. But there's no signs of struggle, no blood, nothing. A search dog picks up his scent and follows it for 3 miles to the bank of the Yellow Medicine River, but then it loses him. So the theory is that maybe he potentially fell into the river.
Yeah.
But the river is searched for 30 days straight. The local sheriff actually walks the 2 mile stretch of the bank every single day for a month to see if they can spot anything. Boats are sent out, divers are going, nothing is found. By 2011, 122 square miles have been searched. There's been horses, aircrafts, hundreds of volunteers. And in 2021, a drought left the river completely dry and it was searched again. But there was absolutely nothing found. No trace of Brandon Swanson has ever been found. No phone, no glasses, no clothes. Like nothing has ever washed up if it had been the river. So the kind of prevailing thought is that maybe he fell in and drowned. Some think that maybe he got hypothermia and kind of succumbed to that after he got out of the river. Some say that maybe there was someone in the dark farmland who saw his headlights and approached him. But one of the interesting things about this case is that the initial response from police, when his parents did report him missing, the police said he had a right to be missing because he was 19 years of age. Yeah. This is the kind of, they don't step in immediately when an adult is reported missing. And this really upset the parents. So they actually advocated to change the law. And Brandon's law, which was passed in 2009, has been adopted in Minnesota and a couple of other states. It now requires police to immediately begin investigating when an adult is reported missing, kind of under suspicious circumstances like that. So at least there was some good to come of it, but a very, very odd
one. Very strange case. Because even in some small thing you'd think would have been found if he had some sort of mishap that he would have. Why did he take it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even he knew the direction he was driving in. So ending up being confused about where he was, fair enough if he was really, really drunk, but people said that he wasn't. And I don't think they were just doing that to protect him from his angry parents.
Yeah.
I think in this case, they would, you know, tell the truth. But he didn't seem drunk. He knew where he was going. He got in the car. He was driving the way that he usually drove. Very odd. Maybe he went through a kind of portal and...
Yeah, well, maybe, but you'd kind of... Because his parents heard his last words and what potentially were his last words. And, you know...
Never made sense of it.
Never made sense about how, you know, that would stay with you, obviously. How harrowing is that? Anyway, case number three isn't so harrowing. It's almost fun.
It's whimsical. Yeah, these are my favourite.
Yeah.
This is honestly a personal hero of mine. This is D.B. Cooper. And it is considered one of the politest crimes in all of history. So it's the day before Thanksgiving in 1971 in Oregon, a man in an ill-fitting business suit, a jacket that doesn't match the trousers, goes up to the Northwest Orient Airlines counter and pays $20 cash for a one-way ticket to Seattle. So he's getting on a plane. He gives the name of Dan Cooper. The name, totally fake. The suit, real, but just not great. So he takes his seat, he sits down very calmly, gets a bourbon and soda, and waits for takeoff. Shortly after 3 p.m., he leans over to the flight attendant and hands her a note, and she just assumes it's a phone number. She must get it all the time. And if you see kind of the sketch of D.B. Cooper, he's a real cool guy. He's got this sort of aviator glasses in the suit, just real calm and collected. She tucks it into her pocket without reading the note, but he leans over and says, "You might want to look at that now." And in the note, it says that he has a bomb in his briefcase. He opens up the briefcase just far enough for her to see what's inside. And of course, there is whatever. I don't know if there was a real bomb, but it's what appears to be a bomb. So this is like a real audacious move and results in just the strangest, most polite crime ever committed in American history. He tells the airline he wants $200,000 in used notes for parachutes. And he wants them waiting when he lands in Seattle. So he also asks if the crew would like meals. He's like just chit-chatting away. By all accounts, he's so calm, mild-mannered. They said he was actually quite a likable character. So the airline has to agree. When the plane lands in Seattle, the money arrives in a canvas bag, $10,020 bills. Serial numbers are photographed and recorded. Four parachutes are loaded. And the 36 passengers who were on the plane were released. But D.B. Cooper stays, and so does the crew. And the plane takes off again in the direction of Mexico City. But somewhere over southwest Washington, with the crew locked in the cockpit, Cooper straps on a parachute. It later actually emerged that one of the four parachutes was a dummy parachute that they'd given him just to kind of test his knowledge of things. But he seems to pick the right one. He jumps, ties the canvas bag of money to himself, opens the door of the Boeing 727 and jumps out in November at nighttime in the rain at 10,000 feet in a suit and loafers.
Yeah.
So he's like, this is not the most like well thought out getaway, but he is never seen again. The FBI spends the next 45 years looking for him. They've given the case the nickname of the NORJAC, which is the Northwest hijacking. And they've kept the files open for years. They've interviewed hundreds of suspects. The name D.B. Cooper actually came from a reporter who misheard the press briefing, because the name that he originally gave was Dan Cooper. But this kind of like, who is D.B. Cooper, has gone on for years and years and years. And interestingly, in 1980, an eight-year-old boy was digging in a sandpit on the bank of the Columbia River. He pulled out three rotting bundles of $20 bills. Some of the serial numbers matched the bills that had been put in the canvas bag. And that's the only real sign. So we at least know that the money made it to the ground.
To the ground, yeah.
Yeah. Don't know. There's great theories online about who D.B. Cooper is.
I know. I think I've interviewed people who've done massive years worth of work on this in terms of where... They think he may have landed and how far he might have to walk to get to civilization and
where he ended up, because they could have traced the money. So it definitely wasn't circulated back into the US economy. I'd say he did make it to Mexico and then went across and exchanged the money somehow. It's definitely been taken out of circulation anyway. But he is one of those criminals that I hope never gets caught.
Yeah. Did they? Well, probably not now. Would he still be alive at this stage?
Probably not still alive, but somebody knows something. They always do.
Yeah. Why did he ask for four parachutes? Was that just in case one of them was a dud?
I have no idea. No idea. In case maybe he was meeting mates halfway down.
Yeah. He just wanted to go through them. And the bag of money they gave him, was it precisely what he asked for, or did they?
No. So they put in a couple. He'd asked for... he'd asked for small bills to not draw attention to himself when he's trying to spend them, I guess. And they had kind of put in a couple of large ones, a few little fake ones. So like he'd felt the weight was, I mean, what you'd estimate $200,000 would be. I don't know how much research he had done, but they didn't give him the full sum of money. But they did give him enough to get away and hopefully live a long and happy life wherever he ended up.
Isn't it extraordinary though in those days that it was, you know, probably didn't come out until afterwards, and there was no hesitation on the part of the airline to just give him the money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was definitely easier to do crime back then, 100%. Yeah. I mean, what options did they have?
Yeah. And that was the day where, you know, the time when they'd serve you drinks and everyone, you know, was lighting up cigarettes and all the rest of it.
Oh,
and
bring it back.
Cassie, thanks a million as ever. Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2:00. On News Talk, conversation that counts.